thank you, Susan, for invitation. And thank you, Eleanor, for talking about science.gov. And I'm going to build on that and talk about the international extrapolation of science.gov into the sort of a global, take the concept globally. It's certainly my pleasure to be here. The title, subtitle of our gathering here is Connecting People to Science and Scholarly Knowledge. And that's precisely what we do at the Department of Energy Office of Scientific and Technical Information. We've been, next slide, for those who are remote. We've been in this business for about 60 years, but over the last 10 years, we've become entirely web-based. Of course, we're not the only ones who connect people to knowledge using the web. Google and Yahoo do this too and do it more famously. But there's an important misunderstanding that has come about. The question on the screen is, true or false, most useful information is available via familiar search engines such as Google and Yahoo. The next slide. And the answer to the question is very, very much false. In fact, much of the information on the web is inherently unavailable to Google and Yahoo. And this key limitation would come as a surprise to many web users, especially young students, who tend to think that if information is not Googleable, it doesn't exist. And boy, is that wrong. People who in the business of making estimates of how much information on the web is non-Googleable, often called the deep web, the lowest I've ever seen is 90% of information on the web is non-Googleable. I've seen estimates as high as 99% of information on the web is non-Googleable. And very important to my organization is much of science is non-Googleable. And information in general, it's not always true, but in general, information that resides in a database cannot be accessed by the Google or Yahoo crawlers or anybody else's crawlers for that matter, and so it becomes non-Googleable. Now, this word non-Googleable, it's my invention. I take full credit and blame, as the case may be. The Google has become a verb. I think that's widely accepted now. It means to search for information through Google. So taking moving from the verb, then we go to the adjective form, which is Googleable, which is pertaining to information found by Googling. And then it's a simple step to go to the antonym, non-Googleable, which is information that cannot be found by Googling, and that's where so much of science resides. It resides in databases. Next slide. I want to make it very, very clear that I wouldn't be talking this way at all about Google and its colleagues unless they'd already been talking that way about themselves. Larry Page, who is one of the founders of Google, personally addressed this year's meeting of the American Association of Advancement of Science, where he lamented that virtually all economic growth in the world was due to technological progress. I think as a society, we're not really paying attention to that. And then he called on the scientists to make more of their research available digitally. Said Larry Page, we have to unlock the wealth of scientific knowledge and get it to everyone. And what he really meant was that the great bulk of science is not Googleable. By the way, there was a very nice article by an employee of Google, one of their directors of research, in the July 27th issue of Science Magazine, and she made this precisely the same point. Next slide. Now, getting back to my organization, Office of Scientific and Technical Information, our mission is to advance science and sustain technological creativity by making R&D findings available to the Department of Energy, researchers, and the American public. And we believe that information fuels discovery, and so our goal is to provide superior access to quality information. We've actually coined what we call the OSTI corollary. We all believe, I think, throughout science, that science advances only if knowledge is shared. The corollary then is if you accelerate the sharing of knowledge, you accelerate the advance of science. So what we're all about is accelerating the sharing of knowledge about science. Okay, why is it that Google can't get into databases? Google uses a technology often called crawlers, spiders, robots. They all mean the same thing, at least for my purpose of this talk. And what Google does, in anticipation of future researches by their customers, they turn their crawlers loose and they navigate the web starting at the top level domain names, and they come down following links as many as they can, and they capture as many pages that way as they can. The number now is in the billions of pages. Now, the problem is when a crawler gets to the front page of a database, where there's a search box that has to be filled out, the crawler is stumped. It doesn't know what search terms enter, and if they entered one search term, that wouldn't give them very much of the content anyway. The crawlers quit. So information, therefore, in databases is almost always non-Googleable. There's an exception, but I won't get into that here. Well, one thing Google wants database owners to do is to rearrange their databases so their crawlers can get to the information. It's called a sitemap protocol, and they're busy, and they partner with other companies like Yahoo, Microsoft Network, in order to try to get into these databases. They're having some success, but I have to say that right now the success is limited. I wish them all the power in the world. But we have another solution. There's another solution that doesn't place any burdens on the database owners. It's called federated search, and it's specifically designed to get into the non-Googleable part of the web. It works differently than Google. Instead of anticipating patron searches, it works in real time. And federated search is how science.gov works, and it's how a number of other products that are some SETI agencies have work, and then also it's how Worldwide Science works, and I'll tell you about that in just a few minutes. What it does is that the patron enters a query in science.gov. Just use that as an example. Eleanor just gave you a live example, a live demonstration of science.gov. When she hit the search button, her query was transmitted to a server which happens to be located in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that query then is fanned out to 30 different databases belonging to 17 different organizations of the U.S. government. The searches are executed individually at each database. Results that are brought back to the server in Tennessee, where they are assembled in relevance rank order, if that's what you want, that's the default, and then presented to the patron. Now, from the user's perspective, it looks very, very similar to Google. But behind the scenes, it's nothing like Google. And the architecture being entirely different, as I just explained. And by the way, one of the key differences is this relevance ranking has to be entirely different. And relevance ranking is very, very important. Google itself acknowledges that their success was first driven by its unique relevancy ranking algorithm and has led to their success. So we tried to accomplish the same thing and by presenting results in relevance rank order, but the approach they use for a crawling technology is nothing at all like the approach you have to use for a federated search technology. Okay. So that's Eleanor did a search in real time on science.gov. I'm going to do a couple screenshots on another product called worldwidescience.org, which does the same thing as science.gov, except it does it on an international level. And I could have done this on a live, too, but it just was safer to do it this way and no opportunities for downtime, but it would work about as well as science.gov. So we do a basic search on the term electric vehicles and batteries. And what happens, you go into Worldwide Science, you enter those terms in the basic search screen, and what you're doing is searching each one of these databases that are named here. as the name of the database is presented, as well as the country that where that database resides. I'll go through these kind of quickly. And what you'll get back with this search is these results like this. The first one being Bascoda, which is Eleanor mentioned. Then the next one is electronic table of contents, which is a very, very impressive bibliographic database compiled by the British Library in the United Kingdom. The next hit you get is from science.gov, specifically the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's contribution, and so forth. Next one is Japan. So we get quite a diversity of responses here, and it just happens to turn out that way. You get more results. Now, you can also have an advanced search feature. One of the strengths of federated search is that you can, if you go to the trouble, you can capture all of the strengths of the subordinate databases. For example, you can do fielded search. So, and, of course, we know on crawling technology, fielded search doesn't work all that well. In fact, if you want to do a search by title alone, you just can't do it. And the so here's a case where we're using avian influenza or bird flu, but we're looking for either pair of those words in the title. And that's on the advanced search screen of Worldwide Science. And then you can also select the source. You don't have to search every source if you don't want to. You can pick favored ones, for example. And then when you execute your search, you'll get a hit list, and then the hit list takes you to the articles themselves. The full text is available, bibliographic information if the text is not available. In this case, full text is available, and there's the full text of the first hit. So federated searching offers some advantages. The advantages are the results are real time. In other words, when Eleanor did her searches, the results came back from the subordinate databases up to the second current with those subordinate databases. There's no burden for the database owner. In other words, we're not asking any of these 30 database owners to do anything different than they normally do, except they have to handle some more traffic. It's very inexpensive to implement. Even an underfunded organization like mine can afford it. And a bottoms-up organization like Science.gov Alliance can keep the thing sustained at least at the minimal level. And by the way, talking about sociological relations, the way Science.gov is organized, the way we want WorldwideScience.org to be organized, is that the participating countries or agencies, in the case of Science.gov, will contribute a minimal amount of money to keep the thing going. $7,500 is the minimum amount you can get away with science.gov per year. But then in addition, various either individual agencies or groups of agencies can get together and on their own enhance the product if they think it's in their interest to do that. And that's happened a great deal in science.gov. So that science.gov 4.0 is a far more sophisticated tool than science.gov 1.0 was not quite 5 years ago. No need to know for the user. By that we mean that there's 30 databases that science.gov searches, and I would venture to say there's nobody in this room who knows those 30 databases. Or if you go on Worldwide Science, where there's about 17 databases now, I think it's an absolute certainty that nobody in this room knows about them. And you saw the list of them. So they're big, but they are also obscure at the same time. Science.gov searches about 50 million pages with each search. We estimate that WorldwideScience.org, of which Science.gov is the U.S. component, is perhaps 200 million pages. So that's a lot of information. We're getting up there around the Google numbers. Google's in a few billions. We're up to 200 million. We have not reached the scalability limit of federated search, but we will sometime. And by the way, there's also a scalability limit on crawling, as is explained in the Science article on July 27th. Google often does not index material that they find. They make judgments about what they think their patrons are going to be most interested in. And that's a lot of it that falls off the edge of the table. So you don't have to know the names of these databases ahead of time in order to do the searching by federated search. You don't have to search them one at a time. So knowing them ahead of time is very unlikely, and searching them one at a time is very, very impractical. Federated search solves both problems. I mentioned that federated searching allows us fielded searching. So you can do very narrow date range searches, for example. You can do title searches. You can do author searches, assuming that the subordinate database has the capability to inform the federated search. All those capabilities are available in science.gov and in worldwidescience.org. Interoperability is automatically achieved because there's software behind this that makes it work, the configuration files, they call them, which translate the patron's query. The server in Tennessee does it in the case of science.gov, and transmits that query to a database. That configuration file has to translate that query in terms that the receiving database understands. And so it's automatically interoperable. Okay, now on the next slide. For the benefit of people listening in, we're on additional points. We're not going to pretend that federated search is a panacea. It has limitations. But neither crawling nor federated search is a panacea. Federated searching does things crawling cannot do, and crawling does things federated search can't do. They are actually complementary technologies, and indeed, you can have them in the same product. And at OSTI, we often do, where we have we have a product called the ePrint Network, which crawls 20,000 university and professional society sites for the ePrints that they have up on their web pages. But in addition, it federates databases, about 15 different databases, including the ARXIVE database at Cornell, which is the most famous of all the ePrint databases, searches them all together, so it acts as an integrated whole. So use the approach which works for you best. And finally, federated searching has advanced rapidly, and I think it will continue to advance because it's so new. Now, getting back to worldwide science, I gave you a demonstration, so let me tell you more about what that's all about. In January 2007, Raymond Orbach, who's the Department of Energy Undersecretary for Science, I worked for him, and Lynn Brindley, who's the Chief Executive of the British Library, signed a statement of intent to partner to develop a global science gateway, which was then yet unnamed. And there's a statement of intent, and that's available on the worldwidescience.org site. We then made phone calls, and we let it be known that we were doing this thing. We announced it at a meeting of the International Council for Scientific and Technical Information in London in January 2007. And by one way or another, we had the following countries come on board and say, yes, we want our information to be federated. Later this week, we expect African portals to come in, two of them from South Africa. At that point, worldwidescience.org will have databases that are searched in every inhabiting continent of the world. And there's just some flags flying from some of the countries that are already exist up in worldwidescience.org. And I don't know why New Zealand's flag is not flapping. There's a glitch in the software. there's no political statement there. So, in short, worldwidescience.org pulls together often isolated islands of information into one easily searchable gateway. Science.gov does that too. Science.gov does it on a national level. Worldwide Science does it on an international level. Well, worldwidescience.org being just launched in late June, we do not yet have a governance structure. We are doing everything, not only is the technology modeled after science.gov, we want the governance of worldwide science to be modeled after the science.gov alliance as well. We are in the process now of creating what we think will be called the Worldwide Science Alliance, And we have some good indications that the International Council for Scientific and Technical Information will be the umbrella organization for it. Of course, that remains not entirely settled yet, because everybody has to feel comfortable that the terms of reference and all that are consistent with them, and they get a proper approval from their senior management and their governments. There's also some technological issues with worldwidescience.org that science.gov, well, they're less pressing for science.gov. They're there, but they're less pressing. For one thing, we got the problem with international arena with not everybody speaks English. And so we have as a goal to make it possible for English speakers to get to search non-English databases and get back results in English. And we also want to make it possible for non-English speakers to do searches of English databases and get back results. We have some projects underway to do that. We have some projects and we have some goals, but we have to wait and see if they're going to be successful. That is not an easy problem. We need to develop translation capabilities, like I just mentioned, but also outside the United States in particular, there are often databases, information sources that are not open to the public. You have to go through an authentication process to get access to the information. We think that we can make that work in a federated environment. We haven't done it yet, but that's another project that we're working on right now. As I mentioned, the International Council for Scientific and Technical Information has indicated preliminarily that it will serve as an umbrella governance for science, worldwidescience.org. And that concludes my presentation. And I think if there's questions, we have time for questions, Susan. And just don't point the questions up here. Ellen is right there. So she's available.